Challah Perek Gimel Mishnah Aleph 3:1, a new perek and a great one, not too difficult and really fascinating. The topic begins with when the obligation to take challah kicks in. Now, the truth is there are going to be two stages to this question, and this really follows the same pattern. If you recall, when it came to Trumas Amisrus, foodstuffs really had two stages. They had Onas Amisrus, which was the earliest time when you could take Trumas Amisrus, and then there was Gmar Malacha, the finishing of the processing of the food, at which point one must take Trumas Amisrus. And there was a difference that in that intermediate stage between Onas Amisrus, but before Gmar Malacha, the food was edible but hadn't finished being processed yet, so one was allowed to eat the foodstuff Achilas Arai in a casual happenstance way, just not Achilas Keva in a formalized way. Remember Maseches Maestros, we discussed that at great length. So something very similar is happening here with challah. We have two steps, a beginning and an end, and the beginning is the earliest time one could take challah, the end is when one must take challah, and between the two, one, as the Mishnah will say, one may eat achilas arai, one may take from the dough in a casual way. So what are those stages? As soon as one adds water to the flour, assuming that you've got the flour made of the five species of grain, wheat, oats, barley, spelt, rye, and assuming that you have the requisite amount of flour, 5/4 of a kav, as the Mishnah says, 43.2 eggs volume. So then the obligation will kick in potentially, and you could at that point already separate challah from your dough, and that will be fine. And in fact, as we'll see a little more later on, I'll speak out that Chazal ended up saying that that's the proper time to take it, midirabanan. So it's taken as soon as possible if the dough is tahor, and to make sure that things stay tahor. But one still need not midoraisa. He doesn't have to take challah yet. And that being the case, one could still eat achilas arai from the dough until the finishing of the processing, which is called gilgul. Gilgul, literally from the word like to roll or rolls together, the idea is when you thoroughly blend the flour and water together, you get like a single mass of dough. It's all sort of uniform and clumped together as one. Once that happened, that's the finishing of the making of the dough, the equivalent of a gemar malacha, and at that point one must take challah, and achilas arai becomes forbidden. I should add, if one didn't take challah for whatever reason, and he bakes the dough, the obligation to take challah exists on the baked breads. But the proper thing to do would be to take it, still take the challah in the dough stage, midoraisa, when it's gemar malacha, finishing of the gilgul, the blending, and then midirabanan even earlier to avoid mishaps. More in the halacha l'maisa a little later on. Now, a side point, barley, which is used to make bread sometimes, a very low quality bread, is very low in gluten and doesn't really clump together very well at all. So we'll see the stage for gemar malacha with making barley dough requires basically packing it down and squishing it together with your hands because it doesn't naturally clump together. It's more like it crumbles apart. It won't stay as a sticky dough, not enough gluten. It sort of crumbles into bits and pieces. And that being the case, it won't make a single gush, a single clump. So you have to sort of squish it together with your hands. If you look at like barley bread recipes, you'll see they always add some extra regular wheat flour to it to make it work. Okay, so that's the backstory here and the beginning of it. So let's start with that. The Mishnah says, Ochlin arai min ha'isa. One is permitted to eat casually, like take a sample of the old cookie dough while still in the dough form, until you finish thoroughly blending the wheat flour together with the water to make a single clump of dough, or ve sitamtem besorim, until you're squished together by hand manually and hold together the barley dough. I should add, Chazal warn that raw flour is kashla kukiyani. It's you can get intestinal worms from raw flour, so they advise against it. And even if you think you sift your flour very well, the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, advises strongly against eating raw flour because of E. coli, which makes people sick from raw flour from time to time. And that being the case, you should not take from the cookie dough or bread prior to it being cooked. In any case, but you wouldn't be in violation of eating challah, the Misa B'Dei Shamayim issue wouldn't kick in for that. The Mishnah continues on, Gilgala b'chitim v'timtama b'sorim. Once you have thoroughly blended the wheat flour with the water into a single mass, or the equivalent with the barley flour, then ha'ochel memena chayv misa. Then the obligation for challah has kicked in, and there's no even permission for a rye, a casual consumption. And if one would consume a kazayis of dough at that point without taking challah first, he is over the isser of eating challah, and there's a misa b'day shemayim, a premature death penalty. Now, the Mishnah continues to say, listen, the proper thing to do is kevin shi nosenes es amayim, as soon as you've added the water to the flour, meaning, but prior to Gilgal, prior to the thorough blending of the water and flour together, already then, magbas chalasa, the proper thing to do at that point is to lift up, meaning to raise up and remove a challah portion. That's a din derabanan. Derabanan, we want you taking it out as soon as possible because we want this tahor dough to remain tahor as challah for the kohen, and the longer things stick around, the more time there is for an accident to happen and make the dough tummy. That, of course, therefore, would not apply if the dough were already tummy. If the dough is already tummy, there's no reason to be afraid that the challah could become tummy, because it already is going to be tummy. And that being the case, it's better to wait till Gilgul, when it's finished being processed, and to fill it properly mid to oraisa. And that's certainly the custom nowadays. Nowadays, people wait until the end, thoroughly blended dough, and at that point they separate it out for that reason. Okay. The Mishnah goes back and says, if you're going to be doing what the Chazal said you should do with your tahor dough and removing the challah early on, prior to Gilgal, prior to being thoroughly blended, you have to make sure, ubilvad shlo yehei sham chameshes revam kemach. You have to make sure that there isn't still 5/4 of a kav of flour in the bowl, in the kneading trough. Because if there is, that is still flour and not dough, so you're not, it's not going to be covered automatically by your taking of the challah. And that being the case, when you make flour and water combination from that flour, you've got a new dough, if you will, that's untied, that hasn't had its challah taken, and therefore you'll be sidestepping and not fulfilling the mitzvah d'oraisa of taking challah. That's no good. So therefore, the Mishnah's point here is you should take earliest on possible, meaning when the flour and water mix, before it's thoroughly blended, midrabanan, but provided that there's less than 5/4 of a cup of flour left of unblended water and flour together. The Yerushalmi points out, and this is how the halacha ostensibly is set, that the truth is you could take your challah prior to the mixing of the flour and water, and even if you still have 5/4 of a kav of flour unmixed with water at the bottom of the bowl, provided that you make a tanai, you stipulate that when you're removing this challah now, you're saying it's only to be effective on the batch of dough once you've got that other flour mixed up with water together, and that would be effective, and it seems that would be like a good way to go about doing it. But in practice nowadays, people just don't do it. They wait till the end because it's all tummy anyways, and they'll take challah after it's all been thoroughly blended. Fine. As I said before, if you didn't do it then, the chiyuv still remains after baking. You'll have to still separate challah once it's baked. And one other point, which is in that on the baking angle, is if one made loaves of bread, let's say, from batches of dough that were not required to take challah from because there weren't the requisite amount, like let's say only one kav, not 5/4 kav amounts, whatever it is. So then, you know, let's say, you know, only 7 cups of flour at a time, but you make multiple batches. So you add one batch of 7, another batch of 7, and so on. And then if you put those breads together in a single container, like a basket, like a laundry basket, whatever it is, single container, that container is going to combine them. And then because of tseruf, they're aggregated together. There's an obligation, once again, to separate challah. So you have to be a little careful of that and be mindful of it. The lachos are actually kind of complicated about when tseruf actually happens. So if you're not sure if you need to take challah or not because of the volume you're using or because you've made 2 batches which maybe are combined, then you need to please ask your local Orthodox rabbi. Challah, Perek Gimel, Mishnah Base, 3-2. This Mishnah has 2 separate dinim, but the first one is essential to get clear for the next coming Mishnayos, several Mishnayos. And that's a very basic idea, which is kind of familiar to us as we've seen in other Trumas and Maestras, that there's a moment of truth, let's call it, where the obligation formally sets in. In the case of challah, there's a moment where that exact time is when the chiyuv challah kicks in. And if for whatever reason, at that moment, the dough is exempt from challah, for some extraneous reason, it will always be exempt. And conversely, if at the moment of truth the challah is obligated, so then later on it won't become unobligated no matter what happens next. And that moment of truth, as we've seen before, is the moment of Gilgul, when the flour and water becomes thoroughly commingled so that the dough becomes like a single mass. So when they're thoroughly mixed, Gilgula, that's the moment where the chiyuv of challah kicks in. And that being the case, the Mishnah says, and it's built on the first case here, we'll see other Mishnahs have other cases of exemptions, but the first case here is based on the exemption that we learned back in the first parak Mishnah Dalid, that meduma is pater, that is to say, a mixture of chulin and truma flour together. Such a mixture would make for a dough which is exempt from challah. And the reason why, again, you'll recall, is because since it has that quasi-truma status already, and the pasuk demands taking truma, as Chazal understand, like making it truma for the first time, if you will, as challah. So if it already has this quasi-truma status as meduma, it'll be exempt from the challah obligation. So therefore the Mishnah says, nidma'a isasa, if one's dough became a dimua mixture, meaning some truma flour got mixed into it, achlo gilgula, if that dimua status occurs prior to the moment of truth, prior to thoroughly mixing the flour and water together, so then, patura, the dough will be exempt from challah because at the moment of truth it already is dimua and therefore exempt. Shad dimua patur, as the Mishnah says, a dimua mixture is exempt from the challah obligation. On the flip side, umishe gilgala, if it happens, meaning that the truma gets mixed in with the chulin dough after gilgal, meaning first she kneaded the dough thoroughly and it's fully obligated in challah, but then it becomes a dimua mixture because truma flour falls in. Well, it's too late, the chiyuv kicked in, and therefore chayeves, the dough remains chayev in the challah obligation. That's the first Mishnah, and we'll come back to that idea again and again in the coming Mishnahs. But now we're going to go to a new point here in the Mishnah, a new idea altogether, a new din, which is that once regular flour, which is already fully tithed, which we'll call chulin, musukana, right? That flour is totally fully tithed, you've had taken truma, meiser, etc. Once you have gilgul and the chiv of challah kicks in again, so now it's tevel all over again. It's forbidden food that must be tithed. The tithe we're talking here is the challah tithe, but it must be tithed. And prior to the tithing, the whole mixture is tevel. The whole dough is tevel, carrying with it the misa b'nei shemayim penalty as truma and challah do. And that being the case, the din here is called like tevula l'challah. Once you do gilgul, the whole mixture becomes tevula l'challah, becomes all tevel again because of the challah obligation. Now, as challah, obligated dough, once it's tevel again, so there's an obligation to prevent tuma from, prevent the challah from becoming tummy. One has to keep it b'tahara. That's what the mishmeres of the truma is upon everybody, and therefore one has to make sure that as soon as dough becomes gilgul, fully dough mixed flour and water together, one has to prevent it from becoming tummy all over again. That's a din d'oraisa, like other truma. Now, if it's safek truma, tamea, meaning the challah the dough is maybe tame and maybe it's tahor, it's a safek, that's called challah tuluya. I'll call it suspended challah in suspense, meaning that what you separate from that dough can neither be eaten, because maybe it's tame, nor can it be burned, because maybe it's tahor. Okay? Nevertheless, even though it's challah tuluya, there's a requirement to keep that dough from getting further exposed to tuma vada. That's a chiyuv d'oraisa. But that also only is true if gilgul has happened. Once gilgul has occurred, you have now a dough that's tevula l'challah, it becomes like challah, and you have to keep it tahor, even if it's already suffic tame, you have to keep it to get any from vada tame status, certain tuma status. But that's true only once gilgul has occurred, the moment of truth. But prior to that, there is a din derabanan that one shouldn't allow his not yet gilguled, not yet fully blended flour and water, soon to be thoroughly blended dough, from becoming tummy. There's a din derabanan for that, not because yet it's tevul l'chala. It's not yet tevul l'chala, because tevul l'chala, making it tevel and having the technical chiyuv obligation, only occurs once gilgul happens. Prior to gilgul, that d'oraisa hasn't kicked in yet. However, there's a d'rabbanan. The d'rabbanan is, you're not allowed to make your not yet gilgled dough, thoroughly blended dough, be exposed to tumah, because of Hefsid Kohen. You're really stealing, you're ruining the Kohen, you're messing him up. Because if it's Tahor and then you make it Tameh, the Kohen can't eat it, you can only burn it. And therefore the Chazal say you're not allowed to expose your, even before Gilgul dough, to Tumah, because then the Kohen loses out and that's not fair and not right. So that's a Din de Rabbanan, and that will stand. However, if it's Suffolk Tumah, meaning you haven't had Gilgul on the dough, and the Tumah we're talking about here is a Suffolk Tumah that was exposed to the dough, so now, if the question is, may one still expose it to Tumah Vade, must one keep it Tahor from then, we're talking again prior to Gilgul, the answer is no, one does not need to do that. And the reason why is because there's no Hefsed Kohen here. The whole rationale behind requiring dough prior to Gilgul to remain Tahor is because we don't want the Kohen to lose out, because once it becomes Tameh, he can't eat it anymore. But once it becomes Suffolk Tameh, the Kohen still can't eat it anymore. In fact, he can't even burn it. It's Teluya, right? It'll be that he can't eat it and he can't burn it. He has to sort of, it sits around and waits to become Tameh until then nothing can happen with his dough. So our Mishnah is going to say that if you're talking about a case prior to Gilgul and the dough gets exposed to Suffolk Tumah, that Din Drabanan of keeping it Tahor doesn't apply. There's no Doraisa because not yet Tful Lachala. It's prior to Gilgul. And that being the case, the Mishnah says you are, yes, allowed to expose the Tumah. In fact, you're almost doing the Kohen a favor because now he will have at least Tameh Vadai Chala, which he can burn, which is something that's better than keeping it around as Chala Tluya. So that's our Mishnah. So now, inside, the Mishnah says, Nolad La Suffolk Tumah, if a doubt arises regarding whether or not this dough is Tameh, Achlo Gilgala, if that suffix occurs prior to Gilgul, and therefore there would only be a Durabanan obligation to keep it Tahor in the first place, which doesn't apply over here, because anyways the Kohen can't eat anymore because of suffix Tumah, then Te'ase B'Tumah, you are permitted, if you so want, to make the dough and do the Gilgul stage already in a state of Tumah, meaning a Tameh person could knead the dough, a Tameh Kli could be used to knead the dough in, whatever it is, that's fine. However, Umisha Gilgala, once the dough has been thoroughly blended, if a Suffolk Tumah crops up, Te'asa B'Tahara, too bad, there's a Chiyav Dorais of keeping the Chala Tahor, and not even Chala Teluya, even Suffolk Chala from becoming Tameh, Vadai, and therefore you have to continue to do everything B'Tahara and try to keep this dough Tahor and the Chala after it Tahor to the extent one can, although of course it remains Chala Tluya, since it's Suffolk Tameh and the Kohen actually will never be able to eat it, he has to just let it sit around until it becomes Vadai Tameh, and at that point he will be able at least to burn it. Chala Per Gimel Mishnah Gimel, we build on what we said in the previous Mishnah, that there's that moment of truth, the moment of Gilgul, when you thoroughly mix the flour and water together, and that's when the Chiyav of Chala kicks in, and if at the time that moment occurs of Gilgul, for whatever reason, the dough is exempt from the Chala obligation, it will always be exempt. So in the previous mission, we talked about a meduma mixture, a mixture of truma and chulin together, and we said that's exempt. This mission will talk about a different exemption, and that exemption is when it's not privately owned. So the pasuk requires ariso seichem, the first of your doughs, but it's your doughs, which we darshan, your personal dough, velo isa shel hekdesh, not the dough that belongs to the Beis HaMikdash. So if dough ends up being the Beis HaMikdash's property, and at the time the Beis HaMikdash's property, the Gilgul occurs, that dough will be exempt from the Chala obligation. Now, just the backstory, so you can make sense of what's going on over here. It was acceptable, maybe even common to do, I don't know, for people to consecrate their possessions and give it to the Beis HaMikdash. Now, if it's the kind of thing the Beis HaMikdash has no use for, so then there's a Kedushas Dam, like an extrinsic economic value to this product which is now given to the Beis HaMikdash, but the Beis HaMikdash will want to monetize that by selling it to somebody else and deconsecrating it. So in the case of dough, what in the world is the Beis HaMikdash going to do with their dough? I mean, maybe they have Kohan to feed, in which case they would feed him to Kohan perhaps, but more likely than not, they don't want your dough. They need the money, the value of the dough. So what will happen is someone else will purchase the dough, or you yourself could deconsecrate the dough onto money. The money now gets invested with the sanctity, the Hekdesh, the Kedusha, and goes to the Beis HaMikdash, and the dough becomes deconsecrated and now can be eaten by whoever you want. We've seen that many times before. So in real life, what might have happened is that a woman, let's say, is kneading her dough. She says, oh, this dough is amazing. This is the greatest dough I've ever seen. I would love to give this dough to God, so to speak. So she'll be makdashit. But now, what's the Beis HaMikdash going to do with this dough? So then she will then deconsecrate it, perhaps, putting money aside so she can eat the dough, and then the money goes to Beis HaMikdash. So that's the kind of thing a person might do. And if you ask, why didn't she just give the money in the first place? The answer is she could, but it's not the same, of course, as giving the dough and then deconsecrating it, which she might want to do. So for, like, I'll call it emotional reasons, but for, you know, certainly understandable and great reasons to direct one's good feelings and one's best things to Hashem in the basement, which is certainly very meritorious and great. So something like that is happening over here. We're going to have a woman who's going to dedicate her dough to the Beis HaMikdash, and then she's going to reclaim it for herself, let's say. For argument's sake, she does the reclaiming, the pidyon, the redemption. So if at the moment of truth, meaning at the moment the Gilgal occurs on this dough, it belonged to the Beis HaMikdash, it'll be exempt. But if she was makdish it, she gave it to the Beis HaMikdash after it had been Gilgal had occurred, or she redeems it prior to Gilgal and then she needs it herself. In those cases, since the Gilgal happens when it's in her possession, it's her private dough, it'll be obligated in challah. That's the Mishnah. Inside the Mishnah says, Higdisha Isasa, if a woman consecrated her dough, Ad Shelo Gilgala, prior to her having needed it thoroughly. So then, no obligation for challah is kicked in. Ufada'a, and then she redeems it. She, the woman, redeems the dough back, again, prior to Gilgal. So now, when she needs it, Chayaves, it'll be obligated in the challah, because the moments of truth of Gilgal occurred under her private ownership. And similarly, if Misha Gilgala, after she needed the dough, then she was makdishit, she gave it to the Beis HaMikdash, the obligation already is kicked in. And that being the case, Ufada'asa, when she redeems it back from the Beis HaMikdash, she's getting dough that's obligated in challah, and therefore Chayaves, she has to separate the challah when she gets it back. But Hikdishata ad shelo gilgala, if she consecrates the dough prior to Gilgal, so it's not thoroughly, the moment of truth hasn't occurred, and then the Gilgala HaGizbar, the functionary of the Beis HaMikdash, does the kneading of the dough, so meaning that the chiyuv of challah kicks in, the Gilgal, the moment of truth occurs under the auspices and ownership, dough's ownership is by the Beis HaMikdash, not by a private person, therefore it's not a riso seichem, and therefore it's exempt from the challah requirement. After the Gilgal occurs, she, let's say, redeems her own dough back again. Then patura, that dough will be exempt from the challah obligation forever. Shebishas chovasa, because at the moment of truth, when the obligation would have kicked in, haise patura, it was dough that was exempt from the challah obligation. Challah perek gimel mishnah dalid. Here we start with the words kayotzibo, which means the same kind of principles apply in another area of halacha. In this case here, we're going to really say the same idea that we learned a moment ago in the previous Mishnah about challah, that it's obligated at a certain moment of truth, Gilgal, and prior to that not, after that not. It's just that moment where everything depends upon. So there's a similar stage when it comes to other tithing, trumas and maaseres. It's also a moment of truth. And similarly, if it's not your dagon, your grain, etc., as the pasuk demands, meaning it belongs to the Beis HaMikdash, it'll be exempt from tithing. Now, if you recall, we've learned Maestros and Trumos already, there are two stages that are significant. There's what's typically called Onas HaMaestros, which means the earliest stage, the fruit is edible. The beginning of Maseches Maestros laid out the actual stage of development for different kinds of fruits, and grains, etc. And then there's Gemar Malacha, which is the finishing of the processing, like in the example of grains, it's meruach akri, smoothing the pile out, whatever it takes to finish the processing of the food, making it ready for storage or eating or sale. At that point, the firm obligation to tithe has kicked in, and that's it. Now, those are two different stages, onus of maestros and gemar malacha. In this Mishnah, we use the terms interchangeably, which is a bit confusing, and therefore some Rishonim learn that the stage we're referring to in this Mishnah, even though we talk about Onos HaMaestros and Gemar Malacha, we're talking about Nigmaru, we refer to, some learn it means the first stage of Onos HaMaestros, meaning the state, I'll call it a third of its fully edibleness, the threshold of edibility. And others, most learn that we're talking about the Gemar Malacha stage, the finishing of processing, and even when it says Onos HaMaestros, although usually in other Mishnahs, Onos HaMaestros refers to that threshold of edibility, the third of growth, etc. In this Mishnah, Onas HaMaestros, which literally means the time of tithing, is referring actually to Gemar Malacha. So which it is a Machlokas Rishonim, but they don't come out the same, that there's that same moment, that one moment of truth, and if the fruits or vegetables or grain is owned by the Beis HaMikdash at that moment of truth, let's call it Gemar Malacha, as most do, then the food will forever be exempt from tithing, and if at the Gemar Malacha it's owned privately, then it's obligated in tithing, whether or not it had previously or subsequently be owned by the Beis HaMikdash. So that's what the Mishnah says. Inside it says, Kayotzebo, the same kind of principles apply as the previous Mishnah. Hamaktish Perosav, if a person consecrates his produce, let's say his grain, giving it to the Beis HaMikdash as Hektish, Ajlo Bol Onos HaMaisras, prior to reaching that moment of truth, the stage of tithing, which let's translate here as Gemar Malacha, meaning prior to smoothing the pile if it's grain, etc., then Upada'an, and then he redeems it back from the Beis HaMikdash, all prior to the Gemar Malacha. So when he does Gemar Malacha, finishing the processing of this produce, it will now be, the moment of truth will kick in, of Gemar Malacha. Then, Chayavin, the fact that the food is obligated in Trumas HaMaisras, the fact that it had at some point been owned by the Beis HaMikdash is irrelevant. And similarly, Umishabola Onos HaMaisras, if the fruit already had their Gemar Malacha occur to them, meaning it's passed through the stage of Gemar Malacha, and then Ufa Da'an, and then he redeems it back. Well, since the Chiyav kicked in already, Chayav, and they remain Chayav and Trumas HaMaisras, even though there was a time when the Beis HaMikdash owned this produce, it doesn't matter, because the obligation had kicked in already at that moment of truth back at Gemar Malacha. However, Hikdishan Ajlo Nigmaru, if a person consecrated his produce, giving to the Beis HaMikdash prior to the Gemar Malacha, the Gamran HaGizbar, and then the functionary of the Beis HaMikdash does the finishing stage of production, let's say smooths out the pile if it's grain. So now that would have been the moment of truth. That's when the Chiyav of Trumas HaMaisras kicked in, but it won't kick in because it's not your grain, it's the Beis HaMikdash's grain. V'achar kach padan, and then after Gemar Malacha, the private individual goes and redeems back the grain from the Beis HaMikdash, deconsecrating it. Well, paturin, the grain or whatever the produce is, remains exempt from Trumas HaMaisras, shebishas chovasan, because of the moment of truth when it would have kicked in at Gemar Malacha, hayu paturin. They were in a stage of exemption because they were not privately owned. Chala per Gimel Mishnah Hey 3:5. We go back to Chala now, but still on the same idea of that moment of truth. Now we focus on the question of when a non-Jew's dough gets into the mix over here, literally and figuratively. So the basic idea, of course, is Ariso Seichem. Your dough means yours and not a non-Jew's, and therefore non-Jewish dough is exempt from the challah requirement. Jewish dough is required to be tied, taking out challah. Now, an important thing to keep in mind is that we're talking about who owns the dough, not who does the kneading. So if a Jew owns dough and gives it to a Gentile to knead, it must have challah taken out of it. If a Gentile gives a Jew the Gentile's challah dough to knead, it'll be exempt from challah because it's owned by a Gentile. That's what the Mishnah says here for starters. Nachri shenasin liYisrael la'asos lo isa. If a Gentile gives a Jew a flour to prepare dough out of it, patura min challah, that dough will be exempt from challah since it's owned by a Gentile. Nasna lo matana. If after that, meaning after the Gentile gives the Jew the flour, the Gentile says, you know what? I don't need that bread after all. You can have it. So now, is there an obligation to take challah or not? The answer is very straightforwardly. It depends. Has the moment of truth occurred? If Gilgul has occurred, so then it was non-Jewishly owned at the time and exempt. If the gift was given and it became a Jewish dough and then Gilgul happens after that, it's Gilgul of a Jewish dough and it'll be obligated. That's what it says here. Natalo matana. If the non-Jew gives the Jew that flour as a gift, achlo gilgel, if it's prior to the fully thorough kneading of the flour and water together, so then when that occurs, it'll be Jewishly owned and therefore chayev, obligated. Umishi gilgel, if the Jew had already thoroughly mixed the non-Jew's flour and water together, and then the non-Jew says you can keep that dough after Gilgul, then Pater will be exempt because at the moment of truth it was not owned by a non-Jew. Now, what about if you have a Jew and non-Jew making dough together as a single batch, like in partnership? So when it comes to two Jews, not the case of our Mishnah, but if two Jews each contributed, let's say, you know, one kav of flour together, said now two kav worth, which is more than the requisite 5/4, and they're preparing one big dough, which they'll divide in half. So that dough will be obligated in, they'll be, sorry, it'll combine to make a single dough owned by Jews and be obligated in the obligation for challah. However, if a non-Jew is one of the two owners, it'll be exempt unless the Jew by himself owns the requisite amount of flour. In other words, if a Jew put in 5/4 of a kav, and let's say a non-Jew added another 3/4, so now you have a total of 2 kav in, but since 5/4 are owned by a Jew, that mixture still must be tithed, meaning challah taken from it, because the requisite amount is Jewishly owned. The Mishnah says inside, Ha'ose isa im hanachri, if one's preparing a dough where he owns a part of the flour and the non-Jew owns part of the flour. Im ein b'shel Yisrael k'shi'ur challah, unless the Jew alone owns enough flour in the mix to be independently obligated in challah, ignoring the non-Jewish component, patur min challah. Without that, the mixture will be exempt from challah, even if combining Jew and non-Jew quantities passes the threshold of 5/4 of a kav. It doesn't matter. It's not enough. It has to be the Jew by himself. Now, just an important point here. In practice, if this actually happens, meaning if a non-Jew does put in the 5/4 a kav and the Jew puts in, for sake, argument's sake, 3/4, you have a 2 kav worth of flour, you make the dough, that dough is obligated in challah because it is 5/4 of a kav belong to a Jew. So you are allowed, yes, you may take challah from the combined doughs, even though some of what you're taking out will be, let's say, potentially Gentile-owned dough and exempt from challah, one may take the challah out while still the doughs are conjoined. And the reason why is because, first of all, we say that there is bila b'davar lach, that if you have something which is like a liquid that can be thoroughly blended, and we do say that all the pieces are exactly blended together, prorated, so you get the mathematical right amount when you take out the dough. But more than that, you might say, well, good, if that's the case, so then your sum of the, in the example I gave, 5/8, right? 5/8 of the dough were Jewishly owned and 3/8 were non-Jewishly owned. So you'd say, listen, so only 5/8 of what you're calling challah is really challah and 3/8 is not eligible, so it'd be taken from exempt dough on chiyuv dough. So it's still okay. And the reason why is because, if you recall, Mid-Oraisa, there's no shear at all. This is only a shear derabanan, and in such a case, it's the shear of taking 1/24 of your private dough is only a rabbinic requirement, and here the rabbi is allowed. And that being the case, it's no problem. That's how the Shulchan Aruch, in fact, paskins la halacha. Challah, Per Gimel, Mishnah Vav 3:6. The last one of this topic here, this is a great Mishnah. We're talking here about a person who converts to being Jewish. So, as we established in the previous Mishnayos, there's that moment of truth, Gilgul, and if it's owned, the dough is owned by a Jew, so then at the moment of Gilgul, it's obligated in the challah obligation, and if not, then it's exempt. So here are cases, a person who, let's say a non-Jew, owns some flour, gives it to someone to prepare a dough, and then the non-Jew converts, becoming a Jew. And perhaps it could be not necessarily clear if the conversion happened before or after the kneading of the dough. If the conversion happened first, then of course it was Jewishly owned at the time of Gilgul and it'll be chayev. And if the conversion happened afterwards, then it'll be pater. And if you don't know, it'll be a suffix. How to deal with the suffix we'll talk about here in the Mishnah. And it says inside, ger shniz gayer, if you have a convert who converted to being Jewish, v'haislo isa, and he had some dough. Naasis achlo niz gayer, if the dough was prepared, meaning the Gilgul, moment of truth occurred, prior to the conversion, then pater, because at the moment of truth, it was non-Jewishly owned. Umishnis gayer, if first the person converted and then his dough was kneaded, Gilgul, then chayev, because at the moment of truth, it was owned by a Jewish convert, and therefore obligated in challah. Vim safek, and if you're not sure, I mean, we don't know what happened first, the conversion or the Gilgul, then chayev. Chayev, you have to still take challah, misafek. This is because there's a challah is a iser. It's a, you know, forbidden substance. You can't eat it if you're not a Kohen. And it's midoraisa. So a safek iser certainly has to be machmir on. So you'll have to take out challah to make sure that there's no possibility of a non-Kohen eating something forbidden to him. Now, while that's true from an Isser point of view, meaning Isser v'heter, I'll call it ritual law, for lack of a better term, it's obligated, you must take challah. But from a monetary side of things, usually if you recall back when it came to Trumos, there was two components. There was, if you ate if you non-Cohen ate a Cohen's Truma, you'd have to give him back his Truma that you ate, and you'd actually have to even add an extra chomesh, 25% more. If you recall, that was doing two separate things. One is the Torah mandates that you reconstitute that truma, recreating it again, and that's part of that is to get a kapara. One gets atonement by recreating the truma that he ate, by taking nuchulin and making a truma. And second of all, there's a financial component. You ate something that didn't belong to you. You ate some Cohen's food. You have to pay him back what you ate, of course. So it's a monetary thing. So too over here, if you are not sure whether this dough has to have challah removed from it. So we're saying because of the suffix isser, maybe it's forbidden to eat. So of course you have to remove the challah. But since from a financial point of view, monetary law, the Kohen certainly has no claim on this dough because hamotzim b'chaver lavaraya, the burden of proof for the one who wants to make a financial claim, rests upon the person trying to exact money out of the one who currently has it. So here, the non-Cohen, let's say, has the recent convert now has some challah in his hands. That's great. He'll have to give it to a Cohen because he can't eat it himself. But since economically he doesn't have to give it to the Cohen, just he can't eat it himself, so he's allowed to give it to the Cohen for a price. He can sell it to the Cohen for the prevailing prices of challah and truma, etc., and the Kohen will have to pay for it, because the challah, economically, is still an asset that the convert can keep or sell or make use of, just he can't eat it. So that's the case over here too. He'll have to remove the challah, but he could sell it to a Kohen, as opposed to just give it to a Kohen. And as for the usual chomesh that one has to add, if one inadvertently ate truma or challah as a non-Kohen, he has to not just give back the keren, the principal value, but also adding 25%, the chomesh. So that won't apply over here in the case of the safek challah, because the point of the there's two components. There's the economic issue of making the Cohen whole. That's not relevant over here, because as we said, you can sell it to him. There's the issue of the mandate of getting kapara, recreating this challah, which you have to do, even if you'd have to do that anyways, because the Torah requires, and that's part of your kapara, but to get atonement for someone who ate from this challah illegally as a non-Cohen. But the guy who ate it, so he will get his kapara from just reinstituting keren. The chomesh, the extra 25%, is not ma'akev, it's not essential, meaning one's supposed to add 25% when he gives back challah that he ate, but if he doesn't, he still gets the kapara. So here, there's no obligation economically, because it's suffix, and he gets the kapara he needs by just doing the keren components, the principal value of what he ate, and therefore if one eats this suffix challah, and he's not a Kohen, he'll have to replace it, but only the keren, and not the chomesh. And that's what the Mishnah says here, vein chayavin aleha chomesh. He doesn't need to add the chomesh when he reinstitutes what he recompensates by recreating what he consumed illegally as the suffix challah. Now we're done with that series of Mishnayos discussing that moment of truth, and really that topic's over. The Mishnah now has one more point, which is really quite a curveball. It just throws it out there. Up to now, for the whole Masechta, we've been assuming that the moment of truth, when does the obligation of taking challah kick in? At Gilgal, when you mix the flour and water. Here we have Rabbi Kiva Shita. Rabbi Kiva says no. That's never been the relevant moment. He just rejects the entire idea of Gilgal being significant. For Rabbi Akiva, the moment when challah must be taken has nothing to do with the mixing of the flour and water. It has to do when the dough begins to turn into bread, which is when it starts to develop a crust. So Rabbi Akiva is arguing with all the previous Mishnayos, and he's saying the moment of truth, he agrees there's a moment of truth, and the questions about non-Jews and conversion and dimua, all that kind of stuff, are all questions, but the answer remains, it depends, was it obligated at the moment of truth or wasn't it? It's just that Rabbi Akiva has a different definition for the moment of truth. He says it's crusting, as opposed to a crusting of the dough in the oven, as opposed to mixing the flour and water together. So the halacha is not like Rabbi Akiva, So this won't have that far-reaching ramifications, but certainly the Mishnayos will have to be reread according to Rabbi Akiva throughout. And here Rabbi Akiva says, Rabbi Akiva Omer, Hakol, everything, meaning the obligation for challah taking, Holech Achar Hakrima B'Tanur. It all depends upon the developing of a crust while in the oven. That's Rabbi Akiva Shita, but again, the halacha does not follow him. The halacha is like all the previous Mishnayos, that the moment of truth, everything depends upon, is thoroughly kneading the flour and water together. Challah Per Gimel, Mishnah Zayin, 3:7. We now talk about mixtures of flour made from wheat and flour made from rice combining together. So we've already established in the first parak of the Masechta that it's only the chameshet mine dagan, the five species of grain, specifically wheat, barley, oats, spelt, and rye, which can make doughs that are obligated in challah, and similarly make matzahs that are useful for fulfilling the mitzvah, v'chilas matzah on Pesach. So those are the five, and rice is not on that list. However, our Mishnah will say if you have a mixture of wheat and rice flours together, it may well be that the mixture is obligated in the challah and could be used to make matzahs on Pesach. Now there's a machlokas Rishonim if this is something totally peculiar to wheat and rice, or if it is any grain that's obligated with any grain that isn't obligated. It seems to me, Shami, we're talking about wheat and rice specifically, and let's stick to that to keep things simple and go with those mefarshim. So, that being the case, the question of the Mishnah is, what happens if ha'ose isa min ha'chitim u min ha'orez? What if one makes his dough from flour that came partially from wheat flour and partially from rice flour? Now, let's even say that the majority is rice flour and the minority is wheat. Even so, im yesh ba tam dagan, if you can taste the wheat in the mix, chayavas b'challah, then the whole dough will have a wheat dough status and be obligated in challah. The reason why is because of the principle of tam ke'ikar, that if the taste is present, it's like the thing itself is present, and if you can taste wheat, the wheat is like a source of, I'll call it iser, in as much as the challah has to be taken out of it, and therefore the whole mixture now gets the status of something that has to have challah taken out of it because of tam ke'ikar, and therefore one will have to take a measure of challah on the whole dough, meaning that the whole, you have to take 1/24 of the whole dough if you're a private person. Now just note, this is true even if the amount of wheat in the mix is less than the 5/4 of a kav, and even if the amount of wheat is the minority. If you can taste the wheat, the whole batch of dough has a status of wheat dough, even though there's a commingling of rice. And again, that might just be peculiar to rice. And that being the case, one has to tie the whole thing based on the volume of the whole dough. The Mishnah continues by saying, v'yotze ba, one could be yotzi with such a mixture of dough, if an adam, I should write that poorly, I'm sorry. V'yotze ba adam yidei chovasa ba Pesach. A person could be, fulfill his obligation on Pesach with matzahs made from such dough, meaning matzahs made from wheat and rice flour together. Now you recall, of course, when it comes to matzah, you only can use matzahs that are made from the kind of dough that could rise, have chimutz, rising, and not just be masriach, not just, you know, like a ferment and without rising. And apparently, the matter of fact is that if one mixes wheat and rice together, there's sufficient gluten inside the wheat to make the whole mixture rise. And that being the case, it fulfills an obligation of something that can come to be chimutz, and therefore, one could use this mixture, even if minority is wheat and the majority is rice, to make matzahs that one could use on Pesach. And that's true, again, even if the wheat's the minority. There is a machlokas Rishonim here if there has to be a kazayas. You have to... There's a question of exactly how much wheat flour there has to be if indeed it's necessary to have what's called a kazayas, an olive's bulk amount, for every pras, for every like half loaf. That's a little technical, and I don't want to get into it right here. We will discuss it in Pesachim, but for now, it's a machlokas. Maybe you need to have a certain ratio so that at least you'll be eating it. If you eat that bread at full speed, you'll have a kazayas of wheat flour in it. But in many many, in fact, many Rishonim say, no, even that's not necessary. As long as you can taste the wheat here in this matzah, then it's sufficient, even if hypothetically it would be less than that kazayas per pras ratio. Now, the Mishnah then says the converse is also true, of course. Im ein ba tam dagan, if the mixture of rice and wheat flour together doesn't have the taste of wheat, you can't discern the taste of wheat there. Ein achayavas b'chala, then the mixture is exempt from the challah requirement. Ve'ein adam yotze ba yidei chavasa b'pesach, a person can't use such dough to prepare challah, excuse me, to prepare matzah to eat on Pesach. It's actually not perfectly clear to me at all on why the Mishnah has to speak out this the flip side, really the inverse case, but whatever the reason is, the din is certainly clear that it's all about having the ta'am, being able to discern the taste of the wheat in the mix. Challah Perek Gimel Mishnah Ches 3:8. For the rest of the perek, we're going to discuss the question of what happens if you have some dough that had an obligation to have challah removed from it get mixed up with a dough which already had the challah removed from it. So, to understand this mission, the next few mishnayos, we got to review for just a moment here the rules of mixtures. Now, usually when it comes to mixtures, you go after the majority, midoraisa. There's a bittul berov, the minority loses identity amongst the majority. Sometimes you'll need 60 times against, like for example, we say tam ke ikra when the taste is present, so it's like the thing itself, the isra is present, and therefore you need to have 60 times against. Sometimes midorabanan, even higher thresholds are set. But there are certain cases of various items that are devarim she'enam is batlim, things that just never become batul in a mixture. And one of those cases we will see here in our Mishnah, the next Mishnah is here, where is the scenario of tevel and chulin be mixed together. The rule is that even if you have a tiny bit of tevel mixing a huge amount of chulin, in this case a tiny bit of dough, which is tevel in as much as the challah obligation has to be taken from it, gets mixed into a much larger dough, which is chulin, it's been tied already. Still, the tevel component is not batel in any amount, Now, why? Now, just first of all, as we'll see in Mishnah Yod, this is only talking about a case where what's called a min b'mino mixture, where the two things that are getting mixed up together are of the same type. So in other words, let's say for argument's sake, here in our Mishnah, we've got some wheat flour dough getting mixed up with some other wheat flour dough. So it's two of the same minim getting mixed up. And in such a scenario, tevel never becomes batel. Now, why would tevel never become annulled in the mixture? So there are two different reasons given in the Gemara and two different Gemaras. The Maseches Avodah Zarah and Daf Ein Gimel on base, it says that the reason why is kehitiro kach isuro, which means the same way it can become permitted is how it also becomes forbidden. So what's that referring to? You'll recall when it comes to truma, how much truma must be removed from a harvest of wheat, for example, to make the wheat now no longer tevel? The answer is even one grain. If you take even one grain as truma, midoraisa, that's sufficient for the whole batch, and so too with challah, tiny speck midoraisa would take away the whole batch. So therefore you see that even a tiny speck, a single grain, whatever it is significant in these halachas, and therefore Chazal said they should be significant also in terms of the removal, and therefore you have to remove it. It's not batel, even in the smallest amount. That's one approach, and in such a scenario, it makes sense to us why it would be the case of only min b'mino this should apply, because obviously you can't take one kernel of wheat on behalf of the barley harvest. It has to be wheat on the wheat harvest. So to here, we're talking about if you have a mixture of all the same type, and since even a little bit could fix the problem, so therefore you have to get that little bit out. Obviously, in practice, it could be very difficult to get that little bit out. If you got a bit of dough mixed in with a lot more dough, you can't find it anymore. It's gone. But you have to get it out somehow, as we'll see in our Mishnah here. The other approach in the Gemara, it's in Maseches Nedarim. There, in Daf Nedzayin Amabes Nedarim says that the reason why a tevel is not batel is because if it's a davar sheyesh la matirin, it's the category of things where there's a way to fix the problem. So an iser that has forbidden things would have a solution to solve their problem. Those are davar sheyesh la matirin. Those things, Chazal say, since you can fix the problem, we're not going to let you just ignore it and pretend it isn't there and let it be batel. So in the case of tevel, tevel is a davar shesh them matirim. It's the kind of isser that can be fixed because you can tithe it and then the isser disappears. Meaning, to contrast that, let's say, for example, with bacon. some bacon bits fall in your chalent, so then there's no way to make the forbidden bacon be permissible. There's no way to kosherize, or, and that being the case, it's not a davar shesh lematir, and therefore the rules you need to have, you know, shishim against whatever the story is, you need to have the taste disappear in the chalent. But in the case of tevel, it is a davar shesh lematir, and there is a way to fix tevel, just tithe it, and then it becomes the rest of what was forbidden now becomes permitted, and therefore it's not batal. And the rule is, again, that for Dvarim Shesh L'Matirim, we're only talking about a case of Min B'Mino, but not Min B'Shein Amino. That's the rule. So that being the case, here in our Mishnah, we're going to have, I'll read it inside, Hanotel Sa'or Me'isa Shlohurma Chalasa. If one had a bit of dough, Sa'or, leavening agent, that had come from a dough that had not yet been tithed, and therefore this bit of dough, the Sa'or, still has to be tithed. It's you know, Gilgal happened to it, and therefore it has to have challah removed from it before it's permissible. And v'nos nosoch isa shahur machalasa, and it, the dough, the little bit of obligated dough gets mixed in with the rest of a batch of dough which already had its challah removed. So now you've got a mixture of doughs, a little bit of which still needs to be tithed with the challah component at least. So, two possibilities. Now, to understand the two possibilities here, you have to understand a separate din derabanan. There's a separate din derabanan which says that if you have two batches of tevel, and one is obligated to rice and one is obligated just midderabanan, you can't take from one on behalf of the other in either direction. Either direction. It doesn't help that you could say, oh, I'm taking from the derisa chayav part. It doesn't make a difference. So you'll have to set it up in a case where the obligation in our scenario here is to remove it, is what you're removing, the source that you're tithing the challah from will have to have the same obligation as the sa'or piece that fell into the mixture. Now, as we just got finished saying, midoraisa, it's min b'mino, it's batel barov, it's gone. But midrabban, the rabbi didn't let it become annulled, let's say because of one or two reasons, because it's a davar shesh l'matirin. And that being the case, you'll have to tithe that piece of sa'or that fell in, taking challah out of it. The problem is that it's only a chiyav midrabanan. And therefore, you'll need to source another chiyav midrabanan dough, a dough that has challah taken from it only rabbinically, and take the challah from that batch on behalf of the commingled batch. So how would you do that? Imyeshlo parnasa mimakam acher. If you happen to have sufficient supplies, parnasa here means, you know, supplies, resources to make a second batch of dough, and that second batch of dough you could make only a chayav in challah midrabanan. That could be if you source the dough, for argument's sake, from areas the flour came from around Eretz Yisrael, but not in Eretz Yisrael. Or perhaps a simpler way would be if you just make it, the dough be less than 5/4 of a kav of flour, but with the sa'or you put in, it would pass that threshold. So that means that midrabanan is obligated because you're going to commingle the doughs, because any past threshold, even though midoraisa, it would be exempt. There's not enough untied dough in the equation to need to be tied, challah, to be removed midoraisa. So you would make a second batch of dough. Just for argument's sake, let's say that you have one beitza of sa'or fell in. So the threshold is 43.2 beitza. So you make a batch of dough with only 42.2 beitzas of flour. So it's not obligated to midoraisa, just midorabanan. And you will commingle it with, you'll attach it to, you'll be mitzaref, you'll aggregate it with the dough that has the mixture of chulin tithed and sa'or untithed dough. You have to attach them either by making them yeshochu, that they're touched in a way that, if you recall, that if you pull them apart again, one will take a piece out the other one, or according to Belezer, you can put them in the same box together, and the box will aggregate the two together and have tzeruf. Whatever it is, if you have sufficient wheat to do that, so then that's what you should do. If you can from another place, so then just make a separate dough, connect the two doughs together, and then do the exact math, figuring out how much total dough must be tithed, and then you take, you know, a 1/24 of that and put it aside. Meaning in the example I gave, you would take 1/24 of 43.2 eggs, which is 1.8 eggs, exactly. But if you don't, v'im lav, if you don't have the resources to make a separate dough, this is all the flour you had. Now you're stuck. You have a mixture of tithed, separated dough that's ready to eat, and some s'or which hadn't had the challah removed. It's mixed up together, and you have no other resource to more flour, so you can't make a separate dough to take the tithing from. So you'll have to take it from this mix. In such a case, motzi challah achas al hakol, then we require you to take a challah from this dough, but you can't just take the prorated amount. You can't just say, you can't take 1/24th of the amount of the s'or that fell in. You'll have to take 1/24th of the entire batch of dough. And that's a chiyuv derabanan, another derabanan. This is because of Maris Ayin. We're afraid people will see you tithing this dough. They won't know the dough has been tithed before and it's just having s'or that fell into it that needed to be tithed the second time. They'll think this is a regular dough that you're tithing, and you're tithing it by taking off a tiny fraction of what you ought to be taking, and that's no good. And that being the case, the din derabanan here is, if you're taking from this dough, you'll have to take the full 1/24th of the entire volume of the dough, midrabanan. Challah per gimel, Mishnah Tes 3:9. Kiyotzi bo, says the Mishnah, the same kind of principle that we set up before in the previous Mishnah regarding taking challah from a mixture of challah obligated and no longer obligated doughs would apply if you have a mixture of, let's say, we'll have two cases here, both of fruits, either olives or grapes, that are a mixture of olives with olives or olives with or grapes with grapes, where some of the olives are obligated in tithe and some aren't. So how do we tithe the mixture? Or same with the grapes. And the kind of answer will be the same, which is if you can get a clean batch outside and do all the tithing from that clean batch, which is all obligated, you can take the obligations for the clean batch along with the mixture. And if not, you'll have to tithe the whole mixture. Details now we see in the Mishnah. It says, Kiyotzibo, the same thing applies if you have Zeisei Masik Shnis Arvu Im Zeisei Nikuf. Again, it's a min bimino mixture. You have olives that are mixed together. Zeisei Masik are regular harvested olives that belong to the farmer. They get mixed up with Zeisei Nikuf. Those are olives that were left for the poor, let's say as peah, for argument's sake. So those are exempt from, if you recall, peah, etc., is exempt from the tithing requirements. So that being the case, you wouldn't need to take trumas and maasers from those zeisei nikuf, but they get mixed up together, so you have to tithe just some of it. How do you do that? Or similarly, if you have inve batzir, im inve olelos, you have some grapes that were regular inve batzir, just harvested grapes that are owned by the farmer, which needs to get tithed appropriately, im inve olelos, with grapes that are exempt from tithing requirements. Olelos, you recall, again from Maseches Peah, are those grapes that grew on a misshapen cluster where there's no matef and katef, there's no drop at the bottom and no like shoulder shaping of the sprigs on top. So those misshapen olelos are to be left for the poor, a separate mitzvah to itself, and are exempt in tithing requirements. But let's say someone pulled them off, and now you've got unidentifiable grapes which were olelos and therefore exempt, but get mixed up with your other grapes which are chayv. So what do you do? Same as the previous Mishnah, im yesh lo parnasim makom acher, if you have resources from elsewhere, so for example, you have some other grapes which are totally obligated in tithing, or you have other olives which are totally obligated in tithing in a regular way, then mot lefi cheshbon, then it's easy. Just do the math of how much total grapes you need to tithe, both from the clean batch and as well as the components in the mixture, and tithe from the clean batch on behalf of both, and everything's going to be A-OK and simple enough. True, this is actually not that simple because, like I said in the previous Mishnah, you need to make sure that the obligation that applies to your commingled batch is the same as your obligation in the clean batch, unadulterated batch, which would mean that in the event that the majority of the grapes were chayev and just a few olelos got mixed in, so then the batch still has a chiyuv d'oraisa because the rove still has to be tithed. Then it's pretty easy. You just get other grapes and from that clean batch take for both piles. But if you have a minority, let's say for example, the majority of the grapes in the mix were exempt and a minority were obligated. So now really mid-oraisa is bitul b'rov, and those grapes that had to be tithed are now lost in the mix, and mid-oraisa are exempt from tithing. So you'll need to get from somewhere else a clean batch of grapes, but a clean batch of grapes that only have a chiyuv midrabanan to tithe. You won't be able to use the trick I kind of described in the previous Mishnah of the mathematical trick that the because there's no minimum amounts of grapes that need to be tied. Unlike challah, you need to have 43.2 eggs. So you'll have to find a source of rabbinically tithable or subject to rabbinic tithes grapes. For example, if the grapes, again, came from border in countries outside of Eretz Yisrael, Syria, etc., that's rabbinically required. Or if the grapes grew in Atzitz Sheinu Nakuv in a unperforated flower pot, which again only has rabbinic requirements for tithing, etc., one of those kind of solutions. And then you'll take from, if you have those grapes, you'll take from those grapes on behalf of both themselves and the grapes that are included in the mixture. Fine, but that's easy enough if you have extra grapes. But what if your grape harvest is finished? There's no extra grapes to make a clean, unadulterated batch for taking tithes from. Vim lav, then it depends. Now, if not, then you'll have to take your tithes, of course, from the mixture. But the tithes that need to be taken are four, right? There's Truma Gadola, and then there's Trumas Meiser, as well as Meiser Rishon and Meiser Sheni or Meiser Ani. So those four, they're not quite the same, because when it comes to the Truma Gadola and Trumas Meiser, the gift that the farmer has to give to the Kohen and the gift the Levi has to give from his Meiser to the Kohen, those are Isser. They're forbidden for a non-Kohen to eat, so you have to get them out. The other two, meaning the Meiser Rishon and Meiser Sheni, or Meiser Ani, that's what we're talking about in that year. So those are economic obligations, but they're not, according to Rambam, Bartanur, etc., they're not Usser to eat themselves. So that being the case, it doesn't really matter so much if you give the economic equivalent to the Levi and say, here is your Meiser Rishon, etc. Even if what you're eating is untithed Meiser Rishon, so what? It doesn't make that big a difference, as long as you set up economically, settle the score. So that being the case, the mission differentiates between the two that have to be taken out, the Truma and Trumas Meiser, and the Meiser Rishon and Meiser Sheni, which are just economic requirements. And it says, V'im lav, if you don't have a source of grapes elsewhere to make a clean batch for tithing, and all you have is this mixture of grapes, some of which are obligated, some of which are exempt, so then, Motzi Truma Trumas Meiser Lakol, you have to take Truma and Trumas Meiser on the, let's say, the 2% for Truma Gadola and the 1% for Trumas Meiser, you have to take that out on the whole mixture. So for just illustrate with numbers to make it clear. Let's say, for example, you have 1,000 grapes in the mix, okay? And 100 of those grapes, let's say, are the obligated ones, that'll be meaning, and 900 are the exempt ones. So that would be Chiv Olim Midrabanan in that example. So you have 100 grapes that need to be tithed in the mix, but you have 1,000 grapes altogether. So we're saying, listen, when it comes to Truma Gadola, you need to take 2% out. I have to take 2% of the whole mixture out. So 2% not of the 100, but of the 1,000. That being the case, 2% of 1,000 is 20. You have to take 20 grapes out and not just 2 grapes. And same goes with the Trumas Meiser. It's 1%, so you have to take 10 grapes out, not just 1 grape. But Vashaar, meaning when it comes to the Meiser and Meiser Sheni, Meiser Rishon, Meiser Sheni, those are just economic equivalents. So therefore, since of the 100 that you have in there, I'm using round numbers to be simple, of the 100 that you have in there that needed to be tithed, 10% needs to go as Meiser Rishon, let's say, so that's just 10. So you can take out 10 out of the 1,000, not 100 out of the 1,000. That's going to be fine. And same goes with the Meiser Sheni. You'll take 10% of, I'll call it the 100, and not 10% of the 1,000. The reason why I sort of waffle there is because you probably realize that that's 10% of what remains. Like, say, for example, from Meiser Sheni to 10% of Meiser Rishon, you give, and then what remains left, you give 10% of what remains as Meiser Sheni, etc., for all these tithes, but let's not go there. It's just making the math complicated for nothing. The principle is certainly clear in the Mishnah, which is that Meiser Rishon Sheni, you can tithe just the mathematical economic requirements, whereas Truma and Truma's Meiser, since we're afraid that you won't pull out the right grapes and they're usser to take, you have to therefore take, we have to do parade it on the entire batch, and then we'll be comfortable that when you take out 2% of the entire mix of 1,000, that you did indeed pull out the requisite 2 grapes that needed to come for the 100. Challah Perek Gimel, Mishnah Yud, 3:10, the last of the Perek, and in fact it's going to seem fairly redundant and superfluous in as much as I've done a lot of this work in explaining the Hakdamas to the previous Mishnah, certainly Mishnah Zayin and Ches. But here the Mishnah says inside, Hanotel Sa'or Me'isas Chitim V'nos Natoch Isas Orez. If you take some sourdough from a batch of wheat dough, which was obligated in, that is obligated in the challah requirements, and you put it into a batch of rice flour to make dough there. Now the rice flour, of course, is exempt from challah because not one of the five species. But as we said before, if there's a mixture that includes wheat and rice together and you can taste the wheat, as we said back previously, then the whole obligation of taking challah applies to the entire dough, which gets the status of wheat because of tam ke'ikar. You can taste it. So it says, im yesh ba tam dagan, if you can taste the grain, meaning the wheat, chayev es b'challah, the whole batch needs to be tithed as challah, meaning the challah has to be taken from the whole mixture, including the rice component. Vim lav patura, but if not, meaning if you can't taste the wheat, but you know some's in there, doesn't matter, the whole mix is exempt, right? So in other words, the little bit of wheat that's in there is lost, even though it was tevel before, meaning it needs to be tied, the challah taken from it, it's lost in the mix. So that contradicts what we said previously. We had said the principle was, on the one hand, yes, if you can taste the wheat, it's not batel, but if you can't taste it, it is batel. But we also said that when it comes to tevel mixture, there's never bittel. So, and we explained two reasons for that. Why? Either because the way it permits is the way it forbids, meaning since even a single grain can permit the whole harvest as truma, so then even a single grain can make the whole thing forbidden. Alternatively, we said it's a devar m'sheish l'matirin, therefore it's not batel. We said this already before. The point is, so which one is it? Is it that if you can't taste the wheat, it is batel and no need to take further challah, or is it that challah, tevel that has to have challah removed is never batel, even any amount, and you need to take the challah? So which one is it? The Gemara says, Im kein lama amru ha-tevel oser kol shehu. Why does it therefore say, says the Mishnah, that any tiny amount of tevel, meaning challah obligated dough, should forbid in any tiny amount? So the Gemara answers, yeah, because that's min bamino. It's true, it's not batel, not annulled, but only if you're talking about a mixture of min bamino, where both the heter and the iser, they're permitted and forbidden, the tevel and the chulin, are of the exact same species, like wheat with wheat. But vishalo bamino, if it's two different types of food, in other words, you have wheat flour mixing with rice flour, but no centam. So then the threshold isn't any tiny amount, but as long only if you can still taste the wheat, then it's tam ke'ikar and needs to be tithed. But once the wheat can no longer be tasted, it's considered to be batel, and then no need to take challah anymore. And again, I explained this back in Mishnah Ches, the rationale, the two rationales given in the Gemara for why that would be.